This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. Ukraine officials Tuesday described the first wave of tanks it will receive following pledges by its Western allies. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Ukraine Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba says in the first wave of contributions, the armed forces of Ukraine will receive from 120 to 140 Western model tanks, adding that these will include German-made Leopards, British Challengers, and US M1 Abrams. Kuleba has declined to name specific countries contributing, saying many of them still have to make formal decisions in accordance with their internal procedures. However, he said that 12 states have pledged tanks so far, and Kyiv was working to persuade others to join. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Ex-boxing champion Vladimir Klitschko, brother of Kyiv's mayor, called on IOC head Thomas Bach not to, quote, betray the Olympic spirit and become an accomplice in the abominable war by letting Russia compete.
You propose to authorize Russian and Belarusian athletes to participate in the Paris Games. I tell you, the Russians are Olympic champions in crimes against civilians.
The International Olympic Committee is open to including Russian and Belarusian athletes as neutrals at the 2024 Games and has opened a door to them competing in qualifiers. The United States and its allies imposed further sanctions on Myanmar on Tuesday, marking the two-year anniversary of the coup, with curbs on energy officials and members of the junta, among others. Canada, Australia, and Britain also announced sanctions. Find more on our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. Huge crowds marched across France on Tuesday to say no to President Emmanuel Macron's plan to make people work longer before retirement, with pressure in the streets intensifying against a government that says it will stand its ground. The U.S. has stopped approving licenses for companies to export most items to China's Huawei, according to three people familiar with the matter, with the report sparking expressions of concern from Beijing on Tuesday. Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones has more.
China is seriously concerned about a report that the United States has stopped granting U.S. companies export licenses to tech giant Huawei. That's according to a foreign ministry spokesperson on Tuesday. Huawei has faced U.S. export restrictions around 5G-related items and other technologies for several years. But officials had granted licenses for American firms, including Qualcomm, to sell certain goods to Huawei. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Mao Ning said in a Beijing press conference that China opposes the U.S. abusing an overly broad notion of national security to suppress Chinese firms unreasonably.
Reuters correspondent Fiona Jones. U.S. President Joe Biden and House of Representatives Speaker Kevin McCarthy are set to meet over the country's debt, with a crisis possibly looming. The AP's Ed Donahue reports.
When he was vice president, the president and McCarthy used to talk things over at breakfast at the vice president's home. This meeting at the White House is different. A potential debt crisis is looming. The president's message to the speaker?
Show me his budget.
McCarthy tells the AP the president has always been a person who would like to try and find solutions, work together. But going into this meeting?
The whole government is designed to have compromise. But here's the leader of the free world pounding on a table, being irresponsible, saying, no, just raise the limit, make us spend more.
The president calls McCarthy a decent man who is being pulled by demands from restive Republicans. Ed Donahue, Washington.
American actor Alec Baldwin was formally charged on Tuesday with involuntary manslaughter and the fatal shooting of a cinematographer on a movie set. Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner reports.
Cinematographer Helena Hutchins died after she was struck by a live bullet fired from the pistol Baldwin was holding on the set of the Western film Rust in 2021. The actor has denied responsibility for the shooting, saying he cocked but never pulled the trigger. A sheriff's office investigation is yet to reveal how live ammunition got onto the set outside Santa Fe. Baldwin has blamed the movie's armorer, Hannah Gutierrez Reed, for failing to ensure the weapon was safe to handle. The armorer was also charged Tuesday with involuntary manslaughter.
Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Today is Wednesday, February 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Junaid Wafo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Ukraine wins support for fighter jets as it awaits the imminent arrival of Western tanks.
Ukraine Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba says in the first wave of contributions, the armed forces of Ukraine will receive from 120 to 140 Western model tanks.
U.S. top envoy presses for a two-state solution in the Middle East.
It's important that we all work together, but particularly Palestinians and Israelis work together, as I said in the first instance, to de-escalate, to reduce the tensions, and then to build from there.
And Pope Francis denounces, quote, economic exploitation, unquote, for mineral resources in the DRC in a historic visit. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukraine has won support from Baltic nations and Poland for its week-long quest to obtain Western fighter jets. That ambition follows pledges by some larger nations last week to send Kyiv sophisticated modern tanks to help it beat back Russia's invasion force after almost a year of fighting. Estonian Foreign Minister Urmas Reinsalu urged all Western community countries to speed up military help for Kyiv, including fighter jets. Poland, Slovakia and the Baltic countries, our NATO eastern flank, feel especially threatened by Russia, Associated Press correspondent Charles de la Desma reports.
Ukraine Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba says in the first wave of contributions, the armed forces of Ukraine will receive from 120 to 140 Western model tanks, adding that these will include German-made Leopards, British Challengers and US M1 Abrams. Kuleba has declined to name specific countries contributing, saying many of them still have to make formal decisions in accordance with their internal procedures. However, he said that 12 states have pledged tanks so far, and Kyiv was working to persuade others to join. I'm Charles de la Desma.
France and Australia have agreed to join forces to produce thousands of artillery shells to help Ukraine push Russian forces out of its country. Australian Defence Minister Richard Marles and Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong are in Europe for talks with key allies. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
French and Australian officials say several thousand 155mm artillery shells will be manufactured jointly by French arms supplier Nexter, while Australia will supply the gunpowder. The first supplies are expected to be delivered to Ukraine by the end of April. The announcement was made Monday at a joint news conference in Paris by French Defence Minister Sébastien Lecornu and his Australian counterpart Richard Marles. Australia is the largest non-NATO contributor to Ukraine's war effort. It supplied missiles and Bushmaster armoured personnel carriers. A group of up to 70 Australian Defence Force personnel has also been stationed in Britain to help train Ukrainian troops. Australia also has sweeping sanctions on Russia, the most severe Canberra has ever imposed on a foreign government. Marles told reporters Paris and Canberra are standing in solidarity with Ukraine.
We wanted to act together as a statement about how importantly Australia and France regard the support of Ukraine in the current conflict. Both of us have supported Ukraine separately in other ways, but we wanted to make it really clear that Australia and France do stand together in support of Ukraine in the face of this Russian aggression.
Also attending the media briefing in Paris were French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna and Australian Foreign Affairs Minister Penny Wong. While support for Ukraine's effort to repel the Russian invasion have dominated bilateral talks, Paris and Canberra have also sought to ease diplomatic tensions. Ties between the countries took a serious hit in 2021, when Canberra abandoned a French submarine contract in favour of American nuclear submarines, as well as joining the Trilateral Security Alliance with the United States and Britain, known as AUKUS. Marles and Wong are also due to hold talks this week with British government ministers. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken shuttled from Israel to the Palestinian West Bank on Tuesday, appealing for an end to resurgent violence and reaffirming Washington's backing for a two-state solution to the decades-long conflict. Blinken is urging calm on both sides after last week's killing by Palestinian gunmen of 7 people outside a Jerusalem synagogue and anger among Palestinians over actions by Israeli forces and settlers in the occupied West Bank. He took that message into a meeting with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas in Ramallah, warning all parties against any action that could threaten a two-state solution with an independent Palestinian state alongside Israel. He said Palestinians were facing, quote, a shrinking horizon of hope, unquote, that needed to change.
It's also important to continue to strive not only for reducing violence, but ensuring that ultimately Israelis and Palestinians alike enjoy the same rights, same opportunities. What we're seeing now for Palestinians is a shrinking horizon of hope, not an expanding one. And that, too, we believe needs to change. We're doing it in tangible ways, including our support to UNRWA, about $890 million for everything from food, vaccines, support for refugees, education, etc. And today I can announce that we're going to be providing an additional $50 million. We've reached an agreement as well to provide 4G communications to Palestinians, and we're working to implement that. Meanwhile, we oppose any action by either side that makes that goal more difficult to achieve, more distant. This is a challenging time. I appreciate the president's determination to try to work through it in a responsible way that looks out for the lives of everyone, Palestinians and Israelis alike. That's what's at stake in this moment, and it's important that we all work together, but particularly Palestinians and Israelis work together, as I said in the first instance, to de-escalate, to reduce the tensions, and then to build from there.
That's U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. The United States has been increasing the pressure on Myanmar's military junta, in part by targeting their financial resources. VOA's Veronica Balderas-Iglesias reports that 2 years after the military seized power from Myanmar's elected leaders, the sanctions are still escalating, but the generals remain in charge.
Within 10 days of Myanmar's military coup, the Biden administration issued an executive order to sanction the military officials. The National Defense Authorization Act of 2023 will now expand that ability with the inclusion of the amended Burma Act, introduced last year by Representative Gregory Meeks.
It's a comprehensive, bipartisan bill that holds the Burmese military accountable through targeted sanctions.
As of January, the State Department has designated 74 individuals and 29 entities for sanctions. It has targeted those who support the military leaders, arms traders, and business people affiliated with the regime. On the ground, however, the military junta is still cracking down on the resistance and trying to raise money despite their international isolation. Without the U.S. and other international pressures, things would be even worse, says Erin Murphy with the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
It allows things to flourish, like military trade between North Korea, Belarus. It will also increase narcotics trading. This is a country prone to violence. It's at the verge of falling apart.
Supporting the opposition, though, has been challenging, explains Priscilla Clapp, a senior advisor at the U.S. Institute of Peace.
The neighboring countries do not allow access to other countries. If we can't get material assistance directly into the hands of the resistance, the U.S. government has to work through other means, and that's not easy.
Thousands of refugees and displaced people have been able to find support, according to the advocacy group Fortify Rights.
The United States government is also providing aid and assistance along the border. In Bangladesh, they also just started a very small-scale resettlement program to bring Rohingya refugees to America.
While the timeline is uncertain, Myanmar's military junta has promised free and fair elections to choose a new government. Activist Savita Pandey warns the U.S. and other democracies against legitimizing them.
And that means that not providing them with election monitors or any kind of technical assistance.
Pandey would also like to see humanitarian aid being distributed through community networks instead of government channels, and the United States more swiftly sanctioning the oil and gas sectors in Myanmar. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Veronica. And in India, Rahul Gandhi, leader of the main opposition Congress Party, has concluded a five-month-long food march throughout the country. He was hoping to resurrect the political fortunes of the party that has been pushed to the sidelines in the last decade since the rise of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party. Anjana Parisha in New Delhi reports on the impact of the march.
Unite India. That was the rallying cry as India's opposition Congress Party leader Rahul Gandhi walked across 12 states. Wrapping up the mammoth five-month-long foot march in Kashmir's capital, Srinagar, he said his goal was to counter divisive politics.
The ideology that wants to break the nation, we need to stand against it together, not with hatred, that is not our way, but with love.
Held ahead of general elections due next year, the Unity March aimed to rejuvenate the Congress Party that ruled India for decades, but has been pushed to the margins since Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party rose to power in 2014. While critics and opposition parties accuse the BJP of polarizing India, Modi remains hugely popular amid a rising tide of Hindu nationalism. Rahul Gandhi, the scion of the famous Gandhi dynasty, has often been called an ineffective opponent to Modi. But Gandhi attracted larger crowds than expected. Along the way, Gandhi was joined by farmers, students and activists as he raised issues like rising prices and unemployment.
A man has come out of his comfort zone and is walking on the roads of the country. You can see that thousands have joined the Unity March. We want change and we hope to get it.
The march emulated an old political tradition of traversing the country on foot. Gandhi tried to identify with ordinary people, wearing only a t-shirt even in winter and spending the night in cabins made of shipping containers. The march's impact will be tested when nine states go to the polls this year, ahead of next year's general election. The Congress Party was routed in the last two national polls, and the march can only be the start of efforts to revive the ailing party. While the march has enhanced Gandhi's popularity, analysts say that Prime Minister Modi remains far ahead and is most likely to win a third term in office. Anjana Pusricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
In other news, relatives waited at hospitals in Pakistan's Peshawar on Tuesday looking for family members a day after a suicide bombing ripped through a crowded mosque, killing 100 people, mostly police officers. The attack in the police lines district was the deadliest in a decade to hit this northwestern city near the Afghan border and comes amid a surge in violence against the police. At least 170 people were wounded in the blast, which demolished the upper story of the mosque as hundreds of worshippers took part in noon prayers. Many of the worshippers were policemen on duty in the lines. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Gina Dufour in Washington. Authorities in Canada continue to discover what may be previously unknown graves of Indigenous children at former residential schools. As Craig McCullough reports, the discoveries are being made with the help of modern technology.
The latest discoveries of 66 possible graves are on the site of what was once St. Joseph's Mission Residential School near Williams Lake, British Columbia, about a six-hour drive north of Vancouver. Earlier exploration of the use of ground-penetrating radar found 93 similar impressions last year. So far, only 0.18 square kilometers of the former school grounds have been investigated. This is out of nearly 8 square kilometers. More than 150,000 First Nations children from the 1830s to as late as 1997 were forced to attend the schools. The schools were designed to forcibly integrate First Nations children into European culture. The institutions were paid for by the Canadian government and run by Catholic and other Christian churches. So far, thousands of possible unmarked graves have been discovered across Canada. News of undiscovered graves first emerged in May of 2021 when the Tkamloops-Tiskewempik First Nation in Kamloops, British Columbia, announced that it had found 215 possible unmarked graves. Pope Francis visited Canada last year to apologize for the Catholic Church's role in how the schools operated. Willie Sellers is the chief of the Williams Lake First Nation and says word of more graves is gut-wrenching news.
You know, we're almost conditioned to take that news and not react, but
know, all of us are continuing to hurt, and you know, how we deal with our emotions and how we deal with our trauma is, of course, different in every single one of us.
Chief Sellers notes the school's impact was far-reaching, as students came from 48 First Nations. He says exhumation might happen in the future, but will have to be done in consultation with the different communities. DNA testing would be conducted before returning the remains to families. Just before the announcement from Williams Lake, the Wasush Odnigam First Nation near Kenora, Ontario, announced it had discovered as many as 171 graves near another closed institution, St. Mary's Residential School. Only five of the graves are marked. Chief Chris Skeed says because much of the area is undeveloped, hilly, and now on private property, ground-penetrating radar will not always be feasible. The next step is to bring in cadaver dogs when the snow clears.
Reason being is they wouldn't be as effective in the wintertime just due to the snow cover, but come snow-free, we're looking at utilizing that resource, the cadaver dogs, to search these heavily wooded areas that are still off-site of the former residential school site.
For Angela White, executive director of the Indian Residential School Survivor Society, the continuing discoveries are no surprise. She notes many of the 139 former schools have yet to be examined.
And the fact that there are not so many schools that have had that ground-penetrating radar that it was eventually going to start coming forward with, and the numbers are still going to continue to grow.
As part of the reconciliation process, the Canadian government has announced a $2 billion settlement to be administered by different First Nation communities whose members attended the schools during the day. Craig McCulloch for VOA News, Vancouver, British Columbia.
The first purple visit to the DRC since 1985 is underway, a trip that aims to highlight the human cost of decades of conflict in the mineral-rich Central African country. David Doyle of Reuters has more.
Pope Francis landed in Democratic Republic of Congo on Tuesday. His visit, the first by a pope since 1985, aims to highlight the human cost of decades of conflict in the vast Central African country. Despite being rich in minerals, millions of Congo's people have been forced from their homes and live in poverty. Francis, who struggles to walk because of a knee ailment, was wheeled along the red carpet at an airport on the outskirts of the capital, Kinshasa. Along Boulevard Lumumba, the arterial road connecting the airport to the city, cheering crowds gathered for a glimpse of the pontiff. Speaking before the Pope's arrival, Father Edouard Assongue of the Archdiocese of Kinshasa said he hopes the visit will unite the people.
All the world is watching what is happening here in Congo. They are already talking about what is happening in the East. With the Pope's arrival, the hope is that his presence here will contribute to making people understand what is going on in the East part of the country. And this may be a trigger for peace.
Congo has some of the world's richest deposits of minerals, including gold, cobalt, lithium, and diamonds. But the abundant resources have stoked conflicts between militias, government troops, and foreign invaders. Eastern Congo has also been plagued by violence, connected to the long and complicated fallout from the 1994 genocide in neighboring Rwanda. Francis, whose trip was originally planned for last July, had been scheduled to visit the eastern city Goma. That part of the visit has been scrapped because of renewed fighting between government forces and rebels from the M23 group. Instead, on Wednesday, the Pope will meet victims of violence from Congo's east in Kinshasa. An estimated 5.7 million people are internally displaced in Congo, and 26 million face severe hunger, according to the United Nations. About half of Congo's 90 million population are Roman Catholics. The Catholic Church plays a crucial role in the country, running schools and health facilities, as well as promoting democracy. Francis will stay in Kinshasa until Friday morning, when he will fly to South Sudan, another country grappling with conflict and poverty.
That's David Doyle of Reuters.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Encounter. Next up, policing in America. The death of George Floyd was supposed to trigger a movement for police reform in the United States, but Tyre Nichols, a 29-year-old black man from Tennessee, became yet another casualty of police brutality. What will it take to end excessive use of force by police in America? We'll talk about it next on Encounter, this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and our panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken reaffirmed America's commitment to peace in the Middle East. His remarks came amid a rise of violence in the region and growing concerns over Iran's nuclear ambitions. This and more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Gina Rofa in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The reality on the ground, more than 1 year after the Taliban takeover in Afghanistan, is dire, declared U.S. Ambassador Robert Wood, alternative representative for special political affairs at the UN. The Taliban has barred female employees of national and international non-government organizations, or NGOs, from the workplace. This puts at risk millions of Afghans who depend on humanitarian assistance for their survival, as NGOs, including their female employees, are instrumental in delivering this assistance. Moreover, this unjustly restricts Afghan women's participation in the workplace. The United States calls on the Taliban to urgently reverse this decision. Earlier in December, the Taliban stripped away women and girls' access to education above grade 6. State Department spokesperson Ned Price spoke out against this move.
The United States condemns in the strongest terms the Taliban's indefensible decision to ban women from universities, to keep secondary schools closed to girls, and to continue to impose other restrictions on the ability of women and girls in Afghanistan to exercise their human rights and their fundamental freedoms.
It is not only women and girls who are impacted, noted Ambassador Wood. We've seen the reports that the Taliban ordered judges to impose a strict interpretation of Sharia law, including carrying out public executions, amputations, and floggings. Many Afghans continue to reject these actions by the Taliban. As the Taliban increasingly adopts its old practices, it moves further from normalization with the international community and the legitimacy it desires. The United States remains committed to helping the Afghan people in need, said Ambassador Wood.
We have provided more than $1.1 billion in humanitarian assistance since August 2021, and we will continue to address the needs of vulnerable Afghans in Afghanistan and those who have fled to neighboring countries.
The United States supports the Afghan people's call for women to return to work and women and girls to return to school and university, and for women to continue to play essential roles in humanitarian and basic needs assistance delivery. The Taliban must respect the civil, political, economic, social, and cultural rights of women and girls in Afghanistan. The legitimacy and support that the Taliban seeks from the international community begins with the legitimacy they earn from the Afghan people through their actions.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.